Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in the Watts section of Los Angeles. His family didn't have enough money for a baseball glove, so he fashioned paper bags into gloves. For 19th season, he revolutionized defensive play at shortstop with his acrobatic fielding and artistic turning of double plays. We're honored to have the St. Louis Cardinal Hall of Fame shortstop, the Wizard, Ozzie Smith, as our guest. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760, WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with the Hall of Fame St. Louis Cardinal shortstop, the Wizard, Ozzie Smith. Ozzie, welcome. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Great to be on the show.
Can we start by talking about your mom and your dad?
Well, actually, I was born in Mobile, Alabama in December of 1954. My dad worked for Brookley Airfield there, and my mom was a housewife. We moved from Alabama when I was 6 years old to Los Angeles, where my dad worked for a furniture company called Safeway at the time. And my mom worked for an Armenian home helping the elderly. And she's one of those people that seem to be able to stretch a dime, stretch a penny, and we never really wanted for anything. And I think growing up sometimes, you know, you may be poor, but you don't know you're poor because of the way your parents provide for you. And I came from a family of five brothers and one sister. And we lived in South Central Los Angeles there. We were there in during the Watts riots. Lived across the street from Manchester Recreation Center, where the National Guard set up camp, and that was a frightening time for all of us because we had to sleep on the floor because of snipers and gunshots and all the craziness that goes on. And, you know, that certainly was a scary time for all of us, but we got through it. And, you know, I think we're all better for that experience.
When you were a kid, you played Annie Over. Can you tell us about that game?
Well, Annie Over is a game where you throw the ball up over the roof. I had a slanted roof. So in my infinite wisdom, I thought that my skills were such that I was fast enough to throw the ball up on one side of the roof and run around to the other side, because we did have a gutter. And if the ball hesitated and hit the gutter just right, then it would plop up a little bit and give me an extra second to try and get around there and catch it before it hit the ground, which I was never able to do, but, you know, I continued to work at that, and it was that type of determination that I think that ultimately made me the person and the player that I became.
How many times do you think you threw that ball on that roof?
Well, against the wall, the garage door, the steps, I honestly could not count the number of times that I did that, but it was all in the creativity of entertaining myself. You know, my brothers, they always had jobs and stuff, you know, so I was the only one that had this bug for sports. And so I spent a lot of my waking time. I used to lay on the floor and throw the ball up, see the ball coming down, and actually close my eyes to get the feel of the ball hitting the glove without seeing it. And not knowing at the time that, you know, that was continuing to enhance something that I was born with, and that was the hand and eye coordination, soft hands and stuff. So I spent a lot of time doing that. My mom spent a lot of time saying, boy, put that ball down. Boy, you stop beating the ball against the house. Boy, stop throwing the ball up on the roof. Boy, stop throwing the ball and you're going to break a light. You're going to break this. You're going to break that, you know. But one of those kids. I didn't break a whole lot of stuff. I did on occasion break a lamp out in a bulb out in the ceiling. And we had a door that had glass on it that had steps that we went up to, and I broke that once or twice.
You went to college at Cal Poly on an academic scholarship.
Yeah, actually, I had a, you know, in school was very, very important as far as my parents and stuff were concerned, you know, getting a good education. They wanted us to give ourselves the best chance in life, and they knew that through education we would have a chance to do that. So for me to have the opportunity to play sports, I had to do I had to get my homework, I had to get good grades, and I had to do chores around the house. Bus suds or wash dishes was one of the things that we all had to do. We had to clean up our rooms. We had to we were on a rotation as to whose turn it was to wash dishes, which we were never able to keep in order, you know, because we just boys and one girl, and we never could keep that straight for whatever reasons. But we all had those chores to do, and all those chores had to be done before we were allowed to play sports. So I had to work hard at that.
After your junior year, you get drafted in 1976 by the Detroit Tigers in the eighth round.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of funny. I never got drafted out of high school, and at the time, and I guess when you play with a player like Eddie Murray, when scouts come, they're not looking at many of the other guys, you know. So I was one of those guys that felt it was a pretty good player out of high school, but my size and stuff, I think, prohibited me from getting drafted. Hence, I had to take another route, and that was going to a little small school where I was going to have the opportunity to play. And talking about getting getting a good education and stuff, we were able, if we kept our grades up, to get grants or a partial scholarships and stuff. And that was one of the reasons that I was able to do that, because I kept my grades up, and it allowed me to go to a little small school there in Central California. And I wanted to go to a small school where I was going to have the opportunity to play every day, because the only way I was going to get the exposure that I was looking for was having the opportunity to play. And that opportunity came for me as a junior, which in your junior years, when you have your most bargaining power, because not many college seniors, because of their age, get drafted. So I got drafted by the Detroit Tigers in the eighth round. And at the time, I was playing semi-pro baseball in a little small town called Clarinda, Iowa. And I went back there and met some wonderful people, namely Pat and Merle Eberle, who ran the ball club that taught me how to deal with a young black kid going into a white rural community in the Midwest. And through that program, I was able to get drafted by the Detroit Tigers in the eighth round, as I mentioned. They offered me $8,500, and I felt that if they didn't give me at least 10 grand, they were not going to take a very good look at me. So I took the chance of going back and saying that if you give me 10 grand, I will sign. They promptly told me no, it was not in the budget. So I went back to school in hopes of getting drafted again my senior year, which I did by the San Diego Padres. And they drafted me in the fourth round, and I felt that here was the opportunity and the chance that I was looking for. And being a good businessman that I am, Jack, I signed for that $5,000 and a bus ticket to Walla Walla, Washington.
So, we're talking Ozzie Smith. In that 76 draft, the Tigers took two people, one named Alan Trammell and one named Lou Whitaker. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Krasula.
Welcome back. We're with Ozzie Smith, who was a 13-time Gold Glove Award winner. Ozzie, you signed with the Padres. One of your coaches, your first coach, was Glenn Ezell. Can you talk about him?
Well, you know, sometimes as athletes, you know, we run across these people in our lives that, for whatever reasons, we feel that they always give us a hard time and they stay on us when they don't seem to be on anybody else. And this was a classic case of my feeling that this coach was staying on me for some unforeseen reason. Glenn Uzel was one of those guys, he'd call you Hoss all the time. Come on, Hoss, and give me a little bit more, Hoss. When I was running down the baseline, you know, I'm running with my tongue out, my legs flailing, arms flailing, and I'm all over the place, and this guy's still telling me, come on, Hoss, give me more, give me more. And that was a little disheartening at first, you know, because I felt that I was putting out and giving my all and stuff, and here was this guy that evidently didn't like me and stuff. So I was having a hard time with that, and didn't discourage me because I continued to work hard. I only knew one gear, and that gear is to be the best that I can be and give my all every day. And Glenn Uzel was one of those guys that I think, when I look back on it now, I realize that he saw that something special in me, and he did not want me to become one of those statistics of guys who had great talent but did not apply themselves day in and day out and took things for granted. So he stayed on me to make sure that I did not do that, and I'm forever grateful to him for continuing to have that that put that pressure on me, or keep that pressure on me, to be the very best that I could be.
After just 68 games in the minors, he called you into his office one day.
Yeah,
can you share that?
Yeah, he called me into his office and he said, "Hoss, you know, I know you probably think I've been a little hard on you and all of that stuff, but you know, it was for a reason." He said, "You're one of those special players and one of those rare breed and stuff." And he said, I did that to make sure that you didn't take anything for granted, and you got an invite to big league camp. And, you know, I can't tell you how elated I was to hear that I had finally gotten an opportunity, because as a college senior getting drafted, you know, not many guys get drafted, first of all, and not many guys make it. So at that point, for me, it was just a matter of getting the opportunity. And getting the opportunity to play professional baseball and then getting an invite to big league camp after 68 days in the minor leagues was much more than I could ever wish for. And so now that window of opportunity is there. It's open for me. Now am I ready to step through that window of opportunity?
What baseball player did you idolize and why?
You know, growing up in Southern California there, I used to catch the bus out to Dodger Stadium and would love, you know, sitting out in the bleachers there, would get there for batting practice and watch the guys do their things out in the outfield, never imagining that one day, you know, I'd be on that field looking up in the stands and realizing that that wall was not as tall as it seemed when I was growing up. And there were certain players, certain teams that came to town where you always tried to catch the entertainment because it was going to be entertaining. When the Cardinals came to town with Bob Gibson and Lou Brock and those guys, Bob Gibson hooking up with Sandy Koufax on a Saturday or Sunday afternoon day game, it's just it's what baseball is all about. You know, it's probably going to be a low-scoring affair. It's those type of memories that I have, but there's one player that his style, his energy, his level of competitiveness is something that caught my eye, a guy by the name of Roberto Clemente, who played right field and played right field like no one has ever played the position with a certain degree of freedom, a certain degree of flair and energy that was to die for. I never patterned myself behind a player like a Clemente because his style and stuff is so unique that it's very hard to pattern yourself behind someone like that. But having his enthusiasm and his energy, I think, is the thing that really caught my eye. And I loved his all-out style. He arms flailing, knees knocking, feet flying all over the place. So just playing good hard-nosed baseball the way it's supposed to be played. A little unorthodox with the way that he approached things, but was very, very effective in his ability to get it done.
We're talking to Ozzie Smith. When we come back, we'll ask him about the famous backflip and how he learned to do it. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Ozzie Smith. Ozzie, you were very famous for the backflip. How'd you learn to do that?
Well, you know, as a kid, Jack, I lived across the street from a wood factory, so I used to go over and put a plank between the stacks of wood, and we'd dive into the sawdust. We'd get old inner tube tires, patch them up, have them blown up, and one of my brothers or a friend would sit on each side of them. We'd use that as a springboard. And at that, from that point, it just becomes a matter of having enough guts to try and take your body and have it twist and turn in midair. And that's one great thing about being young. There's no real fear. So I didn't have a whole lot of fear as far as that was concerned, and I always loved to take a dare. And so I was always dared to do it. We used to go to the trampolines on Thursdays. This is when they first started having family fun centers where the trampolines would actually be in the ground, and you'd jump on the trampolines at these little places where you could play. I didn't play miniature golf, but they had, like, batting cages and games and stuff for kids to play. That's really where it all started for me. And then when I got to my first big league camp, at the end of camp, being the youngest guy, you know, I guess one day they thought I was breathing pretty hard to be one of the young guys. And, you know, the older guys give you a hard time about how in the world can you be breathing that hard and be as young as you are and so forth. And to show them that I was not tired, I did my round-off back flip, which requires some energy. So they were well aware of the fact that I could do it. So Gene Tennis, who was a friend of mine, a teammate of mine, had girls that were into gymnastics, and he wanted them to see me do this flip, you know. So I was never able to do it during the course of the season. So at the end of the season, Gene Tennis and my friend by the name of Andy Strasburg, who worked with the Padres at the time, who was the event coordinator, asked me to do it going out to my position. They felt that it was, for Fan Appreciation Day, they felt it would be something very, very special, and it would get the people excited. And, of course, we had the chicken there, too. And so they twisted my arm and got me to do it on the way out. Well, the response was overwhelming, and the chicken came out the next inning, and he imitated the flip and stuff. So it became... the following year, they asked me to do it on opening day, and it became my trademark. So at the beginning and at the end of every season is when I did the flip.
You were with the Padres for four seasons, and then they trade you to the Cardinals. How did that come about?
Well, I think that at the time, when I came into the league in 1978 as a rookie, I came in notably as a great defensive player, not a very good offensive player. And when you get that label or that tag, it's very hard to shake that label and that tag. I did not want to be known as a one-dimensional player. I never looked at myself as a one-dimensional player. But unfortunately, when you're not hitting a ball out of the ballpark, you hit eighth in the lineup, you're not a very big guy, you don't hit with any power, they don't take you very seriously. So I had to deal with that my whole career, knowing that if given the opportunity, I would probably become a pretty good offensive player, because the learning process for me didn't really start until I got to the big league level and after my first year, because it's at that point that the pros are very capable of exploiting whatever weakness you may have. And if you don't hit with power, the guys usually throw that good fastball up in the strike zone, and until you learn how to stay on top of it and drive down through it, you end up popping that pitch up. So I had my share of learning. Fortunate for me, Jack, my defensive prowess allowed me to remain at the big league level to learn the art of hitting, and to learn the art of hitting against the likes of Nolan Ryan, J.R. Richard, Steve Carlton, Fergie Jenkins, Woody Freiman. The list goes on. And, you know, learning at the big league level to hit against the likes of those guys really gave me a greater appreciation for what I was able to accomplish, or what I was able to stand up and say at the end of my career, that, you know, I hit 262 in an era where I think pitching was so good. It gave me a real feeling of gratification and accomplishment.
We're talking to Ozzie Smith, who turned 1,590 double plays, the most of any shortstop in the history of baseball. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're with Ozzie Smith, who played in the majors 19 years. Ozzie, you had a lot of managers. What makes a great manager?
Well, you know, I think a great manager, first of all, you know, he has to have the ability to motivate people. And when I say motivate people, I mean make people believe that they're better than they are. And to be able to take a guy that doesn't have as much talent and get more out of him. And for me, you know, I feel very fortunate that I probably played for the greatest manager that ever lived in Whitey Herzog. It was a man much like all of the great managers that we know. It doesn't have many rules. A great manager doesn't have many rules. But he's very forceful and very straightforward in the rules that he has. Whitey's rules were be on time and give 100%. As an athlete, that should matter. You know, you should be giving 100% each and every day. And not, I say athlete, but this is in life. Whatever it is that you choose to do in your life, you should give 100%, be on time. You learn to live by those, by that creed, and good things will happen, you know, because if you give 100% every day, knowing that tomorrow's not promised to you, I guarantee you that at the end of the day or at the end of whatever time period you have, you're going to be much better off. So, you know, to me, a manager is somebody who just, he allows you to go out and do what it is you do with the freedom to do it without a lot of restrictions, and makes people abide by their rules.
You have said at different times, and I quote, having nothing is a plus. Can you explain?
Well, you know, having nothing is, you know, and I think that when we were talking about that, Jack, it's about, you know, working hard. We talked about it early on. Sometimes if you're concentrating on being the very best that you can be day in and day out, and knowing that you've got to give your all every day. When I was growing up, we didn't know that we didn't have anything, some of the finer things in life that I was eventually able to get as I became a professional athlete. Because, you know, I think my parents did a good job of shielding us from the fact that we didn't have all of those things. You know, people talk about being rich, and they talk about being rich from a financial standpoint. You're rich when you wake up every day. You wake up on the right side of the dirt. We should all be thankful each and every day that we get up that we were blessed to have another day. And all of us were very fortunate we had parents who worked hard to make sure that you know, we were provided for, that we didn't, we certainly didn't have everything that we wanted, but we certainly didn't feel that we went without. You know, when we needed something special for, be it a play or something special going on in school, my parents always made sure that that we did. We always had a clean place to lay our head, and we always had clean clothes to wear. You know, and that really is was what it was all about. You know, making sure that we had clean clothes, we had plenty to eat, and a nice place to stay.
0.1% of the men who played Major League Baseball get into the Hall of Fame. It's the hardest to get into. You're 5'11", you weighed 150. In 19 seasons, you played almost 2,600 games, you hit 28 home runs, so a home run every 100 games. How did you ever get into the Hall of Fame?
Well, Jack, I really can't tell you that other than to say that I think it's based on philosophy and the way you apply yourself. You know, my goal, as I have mentioned, and as you hear me, as I become very repetitive, the goal was really to be the very best that I could be with what God gave me. Do not take anything for granted, because tomorrow is not promised to you. I worked extremely hard at what my mom told me very early on in my life. She said, son, whatever it is you choose to do in your life, you strive to be the very best. And it was that philosophy that I took with me when I went out into the world, that no matter what it was that I chose to do in my life, I was going to work extremely hard to be the very best that I could be with what God gave me. And it was with that that I worked hard. But the real dream for me, other than having the chance to play professional baseball, was the dream of Joe Carter in 1993. Being at the plate in the bottom of the ninth with two outs, with the game on the line, and you're able to come through for your team. That is the real dream for all of us that play this great game. Making it to the Hall of Fame became a byproduct of the consistency with which we did what we did. I worked hard here again at being the best that I could be, and that's all I could be for 19 years. I asked myself the question after each game, did you do the very best that you could do today? And for 19 years, that answer was yes. Now, if you ask yourself that question every day in everything that you do, if in fact you did the best that you could do, then there's nothing else. Now, it doesn't always mean that it's going to turn out the way you want it to turn out. And it certainly didn't always turn out the way I wanted it to turn out. But I knew that on any given day out there, that I gave my best. I gave all that I had that particular day, and it allowed me to sleep better at night.
All of us have dreams, Oz. But for many of us, we think we live in the wrong neighborhood. We're too old. We don't have the money. We don't have the right size. What advice do you give us about holding and working those dreams?
Well, I mean, the dream and stuff, sometimes that's all you have. You know, if that's all you have, then that's what you got to hold on to, and you got to believe that it's possible. When you look at people like myself, who was 5'9", 150 pounder, who had no idea that one day he'd end up in the Hall of Fame, I'm living proof that anything is possible. It's just all in how you believe. If you believe in what you're capable of doing, believe in oneself. And as a veteran player, you know, I'm often asked, you know, well, what is the job of a veteran player? To me, the job of a veteran player is it extends beyond just being a teammate. For instance, when a guy goes bad, and I'll use closer, for instance, those guys are always living in danger, because usually when they come in, the game is on the line. If a guy comes in and, God forbid, that he gives it up and the team loses, to me, when it's at that time that guy needs a pat on the back. It's not when things are going great, because when things are going great, everybody's patting you on the back, telling you how great you are. As a veteran player, it's important for me to go over and give that guy a pat on the back and tell him that, you know, hang in there and get them tomorrow. Because the one thing that you don't want to do as a teammate is allow someone else to lose faith and belief in themselves. Because if you allow your teammate to lose faith and belief in himself, then he's not going to be any good to the team. So as a veteran player, I deem that very, very important.
We're talking to Ozzie Smith, and I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with the Wizard of Oz, Ozzie Smith. Ozzie, every time I've been around you, there's a softness, there's a calmness about you. How'd you get that?
I don't know. I think it's one of those things that I was born with, and I think it's one of the mechanisms that that allows a professional athlete to perform in stressful situations. Jack, I just think it was one of those things that I was born with. I never liked a lot of yelling and screaming, although, you know, pushed to a point, we all reach a point that things overflow. But for the most part, it's just I'm Capricorn by nature, real calm and easy person. I did during my career experience a lot of hypnosis and stuff to try and control the nerves and keep them intact. So it was all part of my nature, and I just kind of nurtured it.
Does that hypnosis work on the golf course too?
I'm trying to apply that on the golf course as well, you know, because talking about golf, it's probably one of the tougher things that I've ever had to take on in my life. And I think, Jack, it's one of the reasons that so many athletes gravitate to the game, because as we retire and get away from the everyday life of battling on in competition, there's a competitive void in our lives once we get out of it. So golf fills that void, that competitive void, because you're not only battling the people that you're playing against out there, you're battling the course, you're battling yourself. So that's why so many guys gravitate to it, because we know that it's one of the toughest things that we'll ever have to do. And if we ever get to a point to where there's any consistency to the game, we know that it would have come from the hard work and stuff that we put into it. And I've always told young people that you only get out of something what you put in. If you don't put anything in, you shouldn't expect anything in return. And for me, you know, I've lived by that all my life, and I know that if I'm going to get the most out of whatever it is I choose to do, then I'm going to have to put my – there's going to be some blood, some sweat, and some tears.
You're 41 years old, and you're ending a Hall of Fame career, and suddenly you have to go into the unknown, something new. A lot of people in this town are faced with having to change jobs at 30, 40, 50. What advice do you give us?
Well, the advice is real simple, that, you know, you don't wait until tomorrow when you walk away from it to decide what it is that you're going to do. If you're afforded the opportunity, then, you know, you should explore some of those things long before you decide to walk away from it. And for me, you know, I vowed to myself that once I decided to walk away from the game, then I wasn't going to be one of those people that continually come back to it. I'm going to be ready to walk away from it, and would have done it for as long as I could, and have some things that you're interested in, you know, get involved in some things that you're interested in while you're still playing, so that it would make for an easier transition.
After you retired, you succeeded the legendary Mel Allen as the host of This Week in Baseball. Can you talk about that experience?
Hello, everybody. This is Mel Allen. You know, getting the opportunity, and here again, it goes back to developing those relationships as you're getting older, as your career is starting to wind down. And the people from Phoenix Communication remember when I was on the Baseball Bunch years back, one of my first or second year, in the big leagues. And when Mel Allen passed away, you know, they came to me and asked me if I'd be interested in hosting the show, which, you know, you never replace a Mel Allen, because Mel Allen was an icon and a real baseball treasure, and it was the show that I used to watch as a young man growing up, watching that every Saturday. That's how I caught up on what happened during the week. And so having the opportunity to follow a Mel Allen on This Week in Baseball was something that I never thought about, but given the opportunity, I jumped at it. I had a lot of fun doing it, and one of the things that one of the best things that happened to me is that my writer, we would tape on Monday, and we would converse on the stories on Monday, and we'd tape on Tuesdays. And one of the things that they did not allow me to do was read teleprompter. I had to memorize all my pieces and everything, and that was one of the best things that they did for me, because I didn't have to rely on the teleprompter, and I think it was more natural.
You're a spokesman for prostate cancer. Why?
Well, because as men, sometimes we're very reluctant to talk about things that that take us out. Prostate cancer is one of the leading killers of men, and it's a silent killer, because by the time you realize you have it, it's too late. And so one of the ways that we as celebrities can use our celebrity is by making people more aware of how, if in fact it's caught early, if it's detected early, there's a good chance that it could save your life. So it's about touching lives, and touching lives in a positive way, and having the opportunity to talk to men and to get them to go to the doctor and get their prostate checked, because it's about saving lives. And if in fact a conversation that they had or they heard me have with Jack Rasula or anyone made them more aware of how important it was to get checked, and early detection means the saving of one's life, then that's the reason that I'm involved in it, so that we can save some lives.
What is the Ozzie Smith Turns 2 for Charity event?
The Turn 2 for Charity is something that I started before I retired. I actually went to two, maybe three ballparks, where it gives the fans the opportunity to come down and turn two with me on the field. And it was raising money to the charity now. It used to be to the Ozzie Smith Charity, but now the Turn 2 at the Hall of Fame goes to the Educational Department of the Hall of Fame. I'm the Educational Ambassador there, so fans have the opportunity on Hall of Fame weekend to come and turn double plays with my guest George Brett. This year was Ryan Sandberg and Buck O'Neill. And I'm hoping to bring some other people on board to make this bigger and better each year. And it gives the fans a more one-on-one conversations with the players themselves, and get a chance to know us on a more personal level. So it's one of those fun things that we do on the Friday before Hall of Fame weekend, the induction ceremony on Sunday. And people have just they've taken to it, and we're raising a lot of money for the Educational Department there in the Hall of Fame.
We've got 1 minute left. What advice would you give to our young listeners tonight?
Well, I mean, the advice is real simple. I mean, I think sometimes, you know, people, when they talk to us, they're looking for that lightning in a bottle. But it's real simple, Jack. You know, you're only going to get out of something what you put in it. If you don't put anything in, then you shouldn't expect anything in return. Nothing in life comes without some blood, some sweat, and some tears. And if you take that philosophy with you as you go out into the world, you'll find out that at the end of the road, having that philosophy, things would have turned out much better. You know, so it's not a lightning in a bottle. It's just it's real simple. It's the little things. Work hard. Do your very best. Be the very best that you can be in whatever it is you choose to do in your life.
Ozzie Smith, thanks for being our guest. Thanks for a tremendous number of fantastic experiences and the style with which you did it.
Thank you very much, Jack. Thanks for having me.
Our guest next Sunday will be the founder of Pulte Homes. which last year built 46,000 homes. Bill Pulte. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spawn.